All right. The one that says Roger Williams. I'm going to explain why that's important. We just went through Thanksgiving. Y'all know the story of Thanksgiving where the Puritans, you know, they were in Massachusetts, Plymouth Rock, whatever, they had their little settlement, and they finally got through the second year they were there, they got their first harvest. And so they, just to thank God, they invited their Indian friends that had helped them, and they all got together and had this thing. And then the colonists kept on doing that. It spread and spread until finally they made it an official American holiday. It's an excellent, excellent, you know, story and all that. So most people get the idea that our country, that the United States, was founded by the Puritans, and that the Puritans are the ones that gave us our distinctive, as far as Americans go, our distinctive Christian attitude of toleration, you know, conscience, freedom of conscience, and equality, and all that kind of stuff. But actually, that's not exactly right. It's true that they did do the Thanksgiving and all that. And it's true that they had the seeds of democracy because they had the Mayflower Compact where they all signed on and they all, that's part of the history of the United States. But what people don't realize is that the real history of the distinctive character of the United States democracy happened in Rhode Island, not in Massachusetts. And it all is because of this fellow named Roger Williams. Roger Williams came over not the first wave, but he was like the second wave. He was one of the nonconformists. America was started by nonconformists. They were people who broke away from the Anglican Church. Anglican Church had broken away from the Roman Church. These people said the Anglican Church was still too much like the Roman Church, and so they broke away from the Anglican Church. The Puritans is a name that talks about everybody who was interested in purifying the church. But that ranges from people who were very high up in the Anglican Church to people who were all the way nonconformist. So when we say Puritans, we're talking about anybody in that area, in that time period, that believed in purifying the church. So that doesn't really define who we're talking about. So when we nowadays we think of the Puritans and who they were, what we really need to realize is that the ones we are now calling Puritans were conforming Puritans. They were not nonconformists. They were Anglicans who believed that the church had to be reformed, but they didn't leave the Anglican communion. They were trying to reform it from within. And they still have that. They have right now, the Anglicans are divided up into high church and low church. And then they have the ones that are called broad church. But the main difference is the high church and low church. High church means tradition. We believe that we're like the Catholic Church. We're traditional. We believe in all the nonsense of traditional Christianity. And the low church is very evangelical. They're just about like us, pretty much. Puritan type, except they baptize babies. But and they have priests and such. But anyway, a lot of low church Anglicans have been really, really solid solid believers. Very, very strong believers.
Is this like the Lutheran Church?
Now, Lutheran Church has a very similar thing. They've got some old church Lutherans, and you got the Missouri Synod, the very evangelical type, you know. It's similar. All Protestants, even Methodists, you've got old church Methodists, and you've got, you know, the really modernistic, progressive Methodists that are, you know, ordaining homosexual pastors and even women pastors. But, you know, the idea is, what I'm trying to show here is that there was such a range of different groups, and that the people that left Holland and came over to Plymouth Rock, we call them Puritans, they were really separatists. And they were Puritans, yes, but they call them Puritans, and the idea is that these Puritans, you know, were one like group. But no, they were Puritans, but this was a special kind of Puritan. They were separatists. They separated from the Anglican Communion. And yet, they still were very, very strict in their... They did not believe in freedom of religion. They did not believe in liberty of conscience. They did not believe that... They had strict top-down hierarchical government, and they wanted the church to run things. So when they left Holland and came over to Plymouth Rock and started the Massachusetts colony and the Connecticut colonies and all those colonies, when they did that, they imposed their religious rule law on everybody in those colonies. They made it into a Puritan type stronghold. And this fella, Roger Williams, like a lot of other people, went over there and they were persecuted for it. You've heard the stories about the witch trials in Salem and all that. Well, these things are, this is exactly their attitude. They were not about to allow somebody have a free, you know, free thinking attitude. And that's why that William Penn started the whole new colony in Pennsylvania, because he was a Quaker and he couldn't get along with these other New England people. So he just moved on farther inland and started a whole new colony, and it was called Pennsylvania because they were much, much more freer. But the truth is, if you want to know how America got really its ideas that we consider distinctively American, you got to study Roger Williams. Because Roger Williams went, he was the second wave of the Puritans that came from Holland. He went over to Plymouth Rock. He got to Plymouth. I don't want to call it Plymouth Rock. There was Plymouth Colony. He got to Plymouth, and they immediately offered him a position, and they were giving him, he was already pretty famous, and he had gotten some notoriety, and so he starts studying, and he had a position in their churches, and those churches were appointed positions. This was a very top-down oriented mindset. These people were not evangelical Christians like we are, like the Baptists are. They were very strong conformists. They wanted everybody to conform to them, but they were separated from the Church of England. So you had Anglicans in New York and Virginia. These were Anglicans. You had Catholics in Maryland, because the Catholics that were persecuted by the Elizabethan, by the Protestant kings. Remember, in England, the Reformation was really a strange thing. You'd have a Catholic queen, and she'd start killing off all the Protestant leaders, burning them at the stake. And then you'd have the Protestant queen get in there, Elizabeth, and she starts burning off the Catholics. And so there was persecution going back and forth. And so they were all fleeing. They were leaving for their lives. And Maryland had all the Catholic persecuted people show up in Maryland, and that's where they could live as Catholics. And then, of course, you had the Puritan types that were being persecuted by their own Anglicans because they were separatists, and they left and went and started New England. Then you had the Quakers that had to leave all the Puritan groups, and they had to start Pennsylvania. Before all of these things happened, this guy, Roger Williams, was a very, very independent-minded. He believed the Bible. He was going to follow the Bible, whatever the Bible taught. And what we find him is he goes from one belief to another belief, he just keeps on progressing. He finally came to the conclusion that there is no church nowadays that's serving God the way the Bible teaches. And he was correct. But he finally died with the hope that, you know, God would someday, he felt that we needed a new apostle to come and reinstall Christianity again according to the way the Bible teaches. And of course, that's not true. We just need to follow the Bible. He was doing the right thing. He was trying to follow the Bible. Very interesting guy. He's one of the first evangelical Christians like of our mold. But anyway, he had some very, let me see if I can see some of them. He was in England, and he was teaching while he was in England views of freedom of religion, that everybody ought to believe any religion they want to, and that the civil power should have no authority to tell you what you have to believe or what religion you have to practice. That was his idea. And that was a novel idea that had not even been brought up since Constantine in the, you know, back in the 300 when he made the Edict of Milan. And the Edict of Milan states that very clearly, and it was superseded by the Edict of Thessalonica. And since then, nobody even seemed to consider it as even a reasonable hypothesis. He believed in freedom of religion, that the civil power should not coerce anybody's belief. And he was teaching that over there in England. He believed in the separation of church and state. This is where separation of church and state comes from. You know, we hear like it's in the Constitution. Well, it's not in the Constitution, and it's not in the Declaration of Independence. It's actually a fellow named Roger Williams teaching the separation of powers. Jesus said, give unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and give unto God the things which are God's. These are separation of powers. This was the principle in the Bible. He starts teaching that, and teaching that the civil power has no authority to to burn anybody at the stake or to tell anybody whatever. It's, and of course, you can see that the people in power were saying, hey, you can't be teaching that. And he believed in separation from the Church of England. That was that he was one of the separatist Puritans. So he was persecuted in England. So he came over in the second wave. But as you can see, he wasn't just a separatist. He was a little bit of a radical. And so he didn't really get along with the Puritans in New England. So what happens is, when he came over with the second wave, they were glad to have somebody so famously persecuted in England, because he was famous over there, and they hated him. And so when he finally had to leave, they received him with open arms and said, we're going to give you a pastorate here. You're going to be bishop of this church, whatever. And he tried for a little while, I think. Anyway, it didn't work out so well. He refused it because in Plymouth, they actually, the church that they were offering was not a separated church. It was a Church of England church trying to reform the Church of England from the inside. So he refused that. He goes to Salem. He didn't actually go to Salem. They offered him. Salem offered him, and then Boston objected to it, and so they had to withdraw the offer. And remember, these churches were hierarchies. One church had power over another church. They had all kinds of competing interests in these churches, so the church in Salem could not just make the decision to hire them. They had to get, you know, permission from the church in Boston, or, you know, it was just a mess. And this is what he was preaching against. He really got himself in trouble. He did go back to Plymouth and ministered for a while. He got himself in trouble because he started studying the Indians. He started going out there and dealing with these Indians, and he recognized that these were reasonable, educated people that had rights and everything. So he starts writing books. Theses against the royal charters that the king has just said, we give you this much land, and he's saying, well, what right do you have? What right does the king have to give this land away? You can't take this land unless you buy it from the Indians. And this was Roger Williams back in the colonial days, and of course, this makes the king and all the viceroys and everybody that's in charge of everything very upset. He's saying, you don't have a right to this land in Connecticut. You don't have a right to this land in Massachusetts. You didn't buy it from these people. You just settled it and keep it by force. You have to buy it. If you don't buy it, you don't make the deal, whatever, you can't earn it. You don't have the right to it. This, of course, got him in trouble. And he started being criminally prosecuted for these seditious views. And so he was going back and forth, going to court and going whatever. Finally, he was convicted. I don't know what he was convicted of exactly, sedition or treason or whatever. So he was exiled from New England, exiled from the New World, and was going to be sent back to England, where he was already in trouble. Anyway, while they were waiting, it was during the winter he was convicted, so while they were waiting for him to be sent back, they gave him probation, I guess what you call it nowadays. He just had to be there when they were ready to exile him. Well, they said he could be free if he wouldn't open his mouth. That's what it was. And of course, he couldn't keep his mouth shut, and he kept on preaching this stuff. And so they finally said, arrest him. And when they tried to arrest him, he had disappeared. Turns out he had walked. He just took off walking down the wilderness. He walks where, if you look at the map, you'll see where Boston is and where Plymouth is and all those places in Massachusetts. He just takes off walking, gets way down the road somewhere back in the Indian country. And he strikes up some friendships with the Wampanoag Indians and makes peace with them and starts living out there in the middle of nowhere, learns this language, starts studying this Indian dialect and starts writing books about these Indian dialects. And he becomes the foremost expert in this Indian language. And of course, all this time he's under indictment. He's supposed to be sent back to England or whatever, but he's out in the middle of nowhere. He's the first Daniel Boone, man. He's way out there. Anyway, finally they find him. They know where he is, and they send to him and say, "You can't be here. You're still in our chartered area." And so he makes a deal with the chiefs of the several Indian tribes there, and purchases Rhode Island. It wasn't called Rhode Island at that time. It was called, I think I put it down somewhere. It was called Where was that? 1631.
36.
1636, right there.
Okay. The
Massanoa Wampanoag. Mm-hmm.
Okay. There was an island there that he bought. It's a huge island over there. Later on, it began to be called Rhode Island, and then the state became the colony became Rhode Island colony. But anyway, he goes a little bit farther, and by this time, of course, he had been joined by a whole bunch of his followers. So he had a colony there. I don't know how many, dozens, hundreds, I don't know. But he had a colony there. He moves and he buys this island from these people all legitimately. He just skips the king altogether. He buys this place out legitimately from the Indians, and he has his own charter based on his purchase from the Indians. Which basically, nobody can complain about that. Not even the Indians can complain that, you know, he bought this land. And he starts these colonies. And anybody who believed like he believed would go to the colonies. And that's how Rhode Island got started. The Baptists, I don't know if you know anything about the Baptists. The Baptists were just starting up as what they call English Baptists. Baptists nowadays like to say that they have an unending line of people who were baptized by somebody who was baptized eventually by John the Baptist, whatever. That's just a lot of nonsense. The truth is, they try to connect English Baptists to the European Anabaptists because the people who wound up being baptized did have some contact with some Anabaptists. But the truth is, these were special English separatists who were trying to believe the Bible. Anyway, they were persecuted by everybody. The English Baptists were said they were called Stay Baptists because they baptized themselves. They started over, you know. And Sea Baptists, whatever. Strange things. But anyway, they were persecuted by everybody. The Baptists were one of the wild groups. They were the way out there groups, along with the Fifth Monarchy men and the levelers and all these people who, they were radicals. The English Reformation is just rich with individuals who had beliefs and were followed, and it was just as rich a diversity of people's thoughts and people's arguments and having scriptures to back them up. And these people knew the Bible. They knew the Bible backwards and forwards. So they had all these arguments. They wrote all these treatises, and everybody was printing everything. They had printers just printing things out. Everybody was purchasing these little pamphlets. And that's why it was so hard. That's even one of the reasons why Oliver Cromwell later on had to say, you know, this is not working. And he made himself the Lord Protectorate, almost like a king. And it fell apart because these people were not just of one mind. If the Puritans had been of one mind, England would never have gone back to the monarchy. But all these Puritan groups were so separate, so different, they did not have any continuity, and so the royal faction came back in and took power, and after Cromwell died, Cromwell was what held them all together. He was the force that held them all together. When he died, nobody could hold them together. They just fell apart, and the royal faction took over and burned Cromwell's bones and all that stuff, you know, because he was a horrible person anyway. These Baptists were persecuted by everywhere. They started flocking to Rhode Island, you know, by the droves because it was free. They had a charter. In fact, let me see, where does it say it? Pocosset Island is the one I was talking about. Anyway, they drafted a constitution, and the second constitution was the first guarantee in history of liberty of conscience, separation of church and state. What we call our American distinctives, separation of church and state and freedom of religion and all that, what we know as the Bill of Rights, the first instance of it is found in Rhode Island, right there, by this guy, Roger Williams, by what he taught. And he read it right into the Constitution that we bought this land from the Indians, we have a right to it, we now make a Constitution, and this Constitution is going to guarantee certain rights. And that's where that's where it comes up. Also, all these Baptists convinced Roger Williams, that he needed to be baptized. So he got baptized, and that's why the Baptists of today will say he was a Baptist. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't a Baptist. He was upset at the Baptist Church for a whole lot of things that he just did not think they were scriptural. And he was probably right. He was very much a believer of the Bible. He wanted to follow the original primitive Bible. He was very much like us, and he would disagree with their very strict ways of doing things according to tradition. He didn't like that. Anyway, he did supposedly form the First Baptist Church of America, because they formed a church and they were Baptist, so it wasn't called the First Baptist Church of America or anything like that. They just nowadays, there's actually a church over there that's called the First Baptist Church of America. And it's the one on the same land where these people, this one started. And there's a competing church across the hill somewhere that's called also the First Baptist Church of, you know, something or other. And they're competing as to who was first, because during that time, all these Baptists were selling there, two Baptist churches got started. And, you know, whether you call the first time they met the first one or whatever. Anyway, it's a funny story. They're all wanting to be the First Baptist Church in America. Another thing he did was, all this time, remember, he's an outlaw. He is an outlaw, even though, according to God's law, he bought this land fair and square from the Indians, but of course the king doesn't recognize him. But remember, he learned this language. He knew the language, the Wampanoag language and this other Narragansett language. He knew these languages. And he wrote books, the first dictionary of these languages. He wrote how to handle these languages, how to understand, how to know. And so these books sold like wildfire. Everybody in England was intensely interested in the Indians. This was big news. They wanted to know about these Indians. And they bought anything that explained it. And here comes the dictionary of how to speak the same Indian language. It became the greatest bestseller ever, you know. It's huge. And it's probably one of the most influential books ever. But because it made a difference in history. Anyway, he became famous just for this book. So he decides they're attacking him. They're actually Plymouth Colony is raising arms and all that to come down and take over all of these settlements that these free Rhode Islanders have made. They're going to come down and take them over because they don't have any rights to that land. So he makes a trip back to England. By this time, he's famous. So he's been an outlaw both in both England and here. And he goes back to England. He has to get, he's got to get the king to agree with him. And he goes to the king and they treat him like royalty because he's an expert in the Indian language. Because he's an expert in Indian language, the king says, sure. And he grants him a charter. So now he has both the Indians agreeing that he owns this land and the king gives him the charter, which solves his basic problem. That's the first proclamation of liberty in the New World. In fact, in any world since the Edict of Milan, it's a tremendous step in our American history. Anyway, I don't know what else I put on here. Oh yeah, you'll read like in 1644, he publishes The Bloody Tenet of Persecution for Cause of Conscience. He blistered the established churches, including the Puritan churches in Plymouth Colony, including the Anglican churches, all these churches, he blistered them because they were persecuting people over their conscience, over what they want to believe. They were persecuting Quakers, they were persecuting Baptists, they were persecuting nonconformists, they were persecuting Indians, they were persecuting Catholics. Everybody's being persecuted back and forth, and he just wrote this book and said, you guys got to stop this. And of course, we all agree with it now. Even Catholics say they agree with that now. He's the one. This is the guy. Roger Williams. It's not really the Plymouth Colony over there that started what we think of as Americanism. It was a fellow named Roger Williams who was a very strong, individual-minded, that just refused to be a member of any church because they all had errors.
What I find interesting is in 1641 that Massachusetts passed its first slavery laws, making slaves legal.
Yep.
That's where it started.
And he was against slavery. This Roger Williams was against slavery. He fought it all the way. Massachusetts was the first state to make slavery legal in the colonies. They passed it and made it legal.
But then in 1952, Providence passed a law forbidding slavery.
Yes, and that lasted until they united the colonies. That was until the American independence. Rhode Island passed the laws against slavery. All the other New England states had slavery. And gradually, slowly, they followed Rhode Island's lead and eliminated slavery. But if you really want to know where Americanism comes from, that what we consider now the distinctive, important things about America, it's Rhode Island. Rhode Island is the
center.
The thing that caught, it started off as an outlaw colony and got the charter just because he had become an expert in the English. It's a fascinating story about this guy. Roger Williams is
And now it's one of the left-wing states.
I don't know about Rhode Island. I honestly do not know. You might know more. I think all of them up there, except New Hampshire, they've lost their minds. Anyway, now that if we're going to get into the study of America, the really thing I think is important about America are the three great awakenings. Most everything else is pretty much, you know, we've all hashed it out. We know about it. America was not started by Christians. And the United States Constitution was not written by Christians. And the Declaration of Independence was not written by Christians. And Federalist Papers were not written by Christians. In fact, they were all of these documents were done by American deists. And you got to distinguish between American deists and European deists. Deism means we believe in God, we just don't believe the Bible. We don't believe... We believe in God, but we don't believe that Jesus is, you know, divine or not. They believe in God, but they're unbelievers other than that. Now, European deists, they believe in a God that started it all and then walked away. So that God does not mess with... You'll find a constant confusion about people who exalt deism. Agnostics nowadays and atheists, they really exalt these people like Thomas Paine and all that, because deism back in those days was the intellectual way of being. We just don't believe the Bible. We believe in God, but we don't believe the Bible. But they don't know how to differentiate between American deists and European deists. European deists like Voltaire, Montesquieu, Thomas Paine, all these people, they were the kind that believed that God created everything in the beginning. There had to be a cause in the beginning. But God walked away and really doesn't care. He doesn't care about you, doesn't care about anything. They don't know if they know that there's going to be some kind of a judgment, but they don't know anything else besides that. And they do not believe in providence. American deists were a whole completely different breed. They didn't believe the Bible either. But that's why there was a falling out between Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Paine during the Revolution, or during the years leading up to the Revolution. Thomas Paine had written some very strong pamphlets, just like Montesquieu had written strong pamphlets in favor of American independence and democracy and getting rid of the kingship and, you know, taxation without representation and all this tyranny that they had. And so he had become a famous fellow, Thomas Paine had, in the colonies, even though he was an Englander. And Montesquieu was a Frenchman. And, of course, John Locke was from England, too. And all these people were writing. These were all deists writing in favor of the new way, which is democracy. And so Thomas Paine then writes what he calls the Age of Reason. You can actually read it. It's available anywhere. The Age of Reason. And very well written, what have you. But he becomes famous. And because of what he wrote, he became an outcast in America. Even though he had written some of the most important documents forming our nation, after he wrote The Age of Reason, Americans dumped him. And the reason why, and Thomas Paine tried to get him to tone it down, to change it. Benjamin Franklin, right? Benjamin Franklin tried to get Thomas Paine to tone it down. And he wouldn't. And he lost all influence in the United States. He finally had to leave. He left the U.S. because nobody could stand him anymore. And it's because he was a atheistic type deist, kind of didn't believe in providence. All of the American deists, all of them, including Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, all of these people, Madison and Benjamin Harrison, all the signers of the Declaration of Independence, with a few exceptions, Carroll was a Catholic, and Benjamin Rush was a, and Patrick Henry was a Christian. And possibly George Washington was a churchman. He called himself a churchman, so he'd be an Anglican Christian. But all the others, just about all of them, were American deists. They believed in a providence God. They were deists. They didn't believe the Bible, but they believed God was a God of providence, that he had a will for humans and that he was directing our our steps. And that's where America gets the idea that we are being guided by providence. And they include it constantly. They include it in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution. You find it on our coins. This was the important issue in that day, that Americans believed that God was guiding us, that we were guided by God in the things that we were doing, and that what we were doing was obedience to God. Whereas the European deists, and you'll see the difference, because just a few years after American independence, you had the French Revolution. If you all studied anything about the French Revolution, very similar to the American Revolution. They were fighting for democracy and getting rid of the king and all the tyranny and all that stuff. But they were run by these European deists. And if you'll see what happened in the French Revolution, they killed, everybody was being killed. It was chaos. It was one of the worst things that has ever happened. The French Revolution was a disaster, bar none. And it only stopped when Napoleon came into power and took over all the factions and basically made a dictatorship over all of Europe. And that's the only way it got stopped. So the difference between the two deisms, and they had a split before this all happened, and the split happened because of Thomas Paine and Benjamin Franklin arguing over whether God is the God of providence or not. And the European side went the French Revolution way, and the American side went the American Revolution way, and you can see the difference, strong difference between those two. That's where we are in some ways exceptional. But just to remind you, just to let you realize, this was not a Christian nation. Democracy was not a Christian movement. In fact, true, strong-minded Christians believed in following the king. And they quoted the Bible. They believed in the king. And we had some Christians that signed. Benjamin Rush was one that signed the Declaration of Independence, and he was a Christian. And we had a Catholic sign the Declaration of Independence, a guy named Carroll from Maryland. And he signed it. So there were some believers, but most of them were deists, and they were following the providential God hypothesis that America is being led by God. And they believed the Bible was a good book. They did not believe everything in it. They believed the Bible according to reason. They would say those words exactly. We believe the Bible submitted to reason. So they didn't have to believe the miracles. They didn't have to believe the virgin birth. They just believed the creation. They believed anything in the Bible, including the moral precepts, and they believed what fit along with scientific, knowledge and what have you. But that's the source of Americanism. But true, if you really want to know why America became so strong spiritually, is not because of the democracy movement of the deists, and not because of the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, and not even because of the Declaration of Liberty of Conscience and all that stuff by Roger Williams in Rhode Island, which gradually spread to all the states and all their constitutions began to adopt it, and then it was adopted into American law. That's not it either. What really makes us so Christian, so many people think it's a Christian nation and that it's always been a Christian nation, is because of the Great Awakenings. The Great Awakenings began in New England with a guy named Jonathan Edwards. This was what's called the Great Awakening. This is called the Great Awakening, or the First Great Awakening. Something happened, and there's no way anybody can explain it. Jonathan Edwards was a dry, Calvinistic preacher. He would read his sermons. There was nothing special about this guy. But he got saved, apparently. He had a conversion experience. Even before Whitfield and Wesley and all these others of the Great Awakening. And something happened. This guy began preaching, and the people around him, it just began to affect them. They would start trembling, and they would have crowds come to hear him preach, and people would just be trembling and wailing and all kinds of things happening in his meetings. And people were getting saved. I mean, people were converting with tears and brokenness, and their lives were changed. And that area of New England just began to be completely transformed. During this time, a guy named George Whitfield over in England got saved. He was one of the groups called the Methodists. The Methodists were about 5 or 6 or 8 people in Oxford who got together and prayed every morning and had a certain method that they did things in order to try to be holy. They were really trying to perfect holiness and the fear of God, trying to get closer to God, whatever. And this fellow, George Whitfield, got saved. Just something happened to him. He got transformed, born again. He called it born again. I was born again. He understood the new birth. He starts going around preaching the new birth. Became famous, like crazy famous. He was gathering crowds like nobody else had ever gathered in history. They say one time he gathered 30,000 people. One time Benjamin Franklin didn't believe the stories. He went out there to see, because he didn't think anybody could gather 30,000 people and still be heard. But what happened was, when people would go to hear him preach, everybody would shut up. It would just be, they said the birds would stop. It was get so quiet that the birds would just, it was just quiet. And Whitfield would always stand by a wall, and sometimes they would raise a soundboard. Huge, thick planks fastened together that would lift up behind him, just like a piano has a soundboard, and it would magnify his voice. But it's still just that. And Benjamin Franklin went out and paced it, did his calculations, and said, yes, there were 20-something thousand people listening to him. And he went out to the end, and he could hear him just fine.
Wow.
So he did a scientific calculation, and it's true. He was gathering 30,000 people when he would preach. And they say that they would send runners to the town where he was headed. And these runners would get on their horses and just go down the streets shouting, "Whitfield is coming! Whitfield is coming!" And they say people would leave their plows and their horses in the fields and take off running to get to the Whitfield is coming to be at the Boston Square at such and such a time. And they would just come from everywhere. It would be like a stampede, people running to get there. And they would get there and it'd all be quiet. He would show up on horseback, come up there, get down, go in there and rest a minute and get out there and start preaching. Amazing. None of the historians can understand it. They don't explain it. It does not make sense. It doesn't make sense because there's nothing in the story to explain why people were so hungry for the gospel all of a sudden. There's no explanation. I can't figure it out. I don't know. I'd like to be able to see what caused this, what caused that, and then what caused that so that I would know how I could reproduce it now. You know? But there's no figuring it out. Nobody can figure it out. Even historians can't deny that there was a great awakening. There was. It completely transformed society. Society before that, they say, you know, they had all these coal miners, and these are the dirt poorest people that, you know, ever were, and worked in the coal mines 14 hours a day and came out only at night, you know, and they die by the time they're 40 and all. This was their life. And their kids would be working in the coal mines at 8 years old, you know, that sort of thing. That was their life. But all of a sudden, and the pubs and all that in the big towns, they were just full. It was just so much vice. But within 20 years, England and New England were transformed, just upside down, completely different. Pubs were out of business. Not because they were, you know, by law made to go out of business. They just couldn't. They couldn't get any customers. They just ran out of business. They had to start something else. And publishing houses just boomed. Everybody wanted to. And they came to become connoisseurs of preachers. They know all these preachers, and then they would compare which preacher is better. And they knew how to make sermons. And I'm talking about average people learning how to read. The Sunday school came about because so many people were so hungry. They needed to learn, but they had to work. But on Sunday, they didn't have to work. So they started Sunday school, where they would teach people how to read out of the Bible and explain things in the Bible. That's how Sunday school got started back in those days. And it just transformed the entire... Even Benjamin Franklin, who was very skeptical, he really liked Whitfield because Whitfield was not like the other ministers. He was just different. He just preached. And he had orphanages in Georgia. And so when he'd preach, he'd take up a collection for Georgia. But for his orphanages in Georgia, people would give the money, and that's how he kept the orphanages in Georgia going. He made a huge mistake in thinking that he needed to hire slaves, and he didn't hire slaves. He bought slaves to run his orphanages, to do the fields and the plantations in Georgia. Big mistake. He paid for that. in bad reputation because of it. Wesley refused it, and of course Edwards and all them refused slavery, but he acquiesced in it. So that was George Whitfield's mistake. But he would raise money. And Benjamin Franklin went one time, he writes a story, you can read it, it's hilarious. He writes a story, he said, I went there very skeptical of this Whitfield guy, and so he went and listened to him. And he said, man, he said, when I was there, there ain't no way. He said he had a little bit of change in his pocket. He said, there ain't no way I'm giving these people anything, you know. But he says he started hearing him preach, and he said, well, I give him the change in my pocket. And then he kept hearing him a little bit more, and he said, well, he turns out hawking his watch and everything, giving him everything he could give him, because he says he just transformed, and of course he invited him to his house, and he became very close friends with this Whitfield, never got saved.
Benjamin Franklin.
Never got saved, but he was enthralled. Just amazed by Whitfield and the appeal that he had and the power of his preaching. He could just change people's minds right in front of them. It's amazing. I've read his sermons, and you know they're not nothing terribly special. You know, now I'll tell you what, I did read one of Jonathan Edwards' sermons, and I mean to tell you, it floored me, left me breathless. It just took my breath away. I read, it's called Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God. And I actually translated it into Spanish. Mm-hmm. And I know other people have said they read it and it didn't impress them, but I tell you, when I first read it, I'm just my heart is just about to stop because of, you know, the idea that really there's nothing. There's nothing between me and hell. Nothing. Except God's
mercy.
God's pleasure. Yep. Just whatever God wants. Yep. Anyway, these sermons were tremendous, and these preachers were tremendous. They were a special breed of people too. John Wesley, he always seemed to have a sense of compensation. He got saved much after Whitfield, and Whitfield was famous. Wesley was not famous. Whitfield was famous in both continents. Wesley went to the New England, to Virginia, tried preaching there for a while, got himself in trouble. He was sued by somebody, and when he lost the lawsuit, they were going to put him in jail, whatever, so he fled, he got in the boat and left. And so he could never go back to the U.S., and so he never had a ministry in the States. Anyway, but he didn't get saved right away. He wanted it real bad. When Whitfield got saved, he was one of the Methodists. John and Charles Wesley were both one of the many Methodists that were in Oxford, and Whitfield got saved, and John and Charles followed him. They were very interested in whatever had happened to him, and they wanted that experience too, but they just couldn't get it. They didn't know what to do, you know. He, on the boat to Virginia, is when Wesley supposedly got saved, and then it didn't really take or something, but he met some Moravian brethren. And the Moravians told him that you have to have the witness in your heart or whatever. Anyway, he said he got it. And then he kept preaching like he got it then. But then after a while, he got it into what they call his Aldersgate experience. If you read the story of Wesley, it's like he never got that same kind of experience that he wanted to feel. And then it looks to me like, and I'm just guessing, it looks to me like he just assumed that he had it and started preaching like, I got it at this point, what they call the Aldersgate experience. Anyway, he seemed like he was always trying to catch up to Whitfield. He wanted to get to that point. But he never could raise those kind of crowds. Wesley would raise 4,000 or 5,000 people, whereas Whitfield was raising 30,000 people. Whitfield was hugely, and Wesley was primarily famous because of Whitfield. He was one of the Methodists, and so he was like a follower of Whitfield. Isn't that like it bothered him? All his life, it seems like it bothered Wesley. And another problem was that Whitfield had embraced Calvinism, five-point Calvinism. He believed in the doctrine of election and reprobation and all that stuff. He was a moderate Calvinist, but he was a Calvinist. And Wesley just got to the place where he hated Calvinism. He was a very strong Arminian. And so, almost using that to compete against Whitfield. And Whitfield tried to make peace with him and said, look, you got to stop this. You got to stop the argument. You got to stop, you know, correcting my doctrine. We've got to be together in this. I mean, we've been, you know, brothers, you know, in the same preaching ministry and all that for years, and it was a big row between them. And they did sort of make peace, but Wesley never could get over two things. He couldn't get over the Calvinism, and he could not get over Whitfield's fame. But Whitfield died at about 56, 57 years old. He died of the consumption, which is what we know now as tuberculosis. He died of consumption, and Wesley lived until he was 90. So Wesley lived probably 35, 40 years after Whitfield, and he pretty much consolidated all of Whitfield's followers behind him. By the time Whitfield died, his name was the next in line, and so Methodists wound up just following Wesley. But these were part of that first Great Awakening. They transformed, and they weren't the only one by far. We're talking about hundreds of itinerant preachers going everywhere preaching because it was really working, really working. That's the first Great Awakening. Now, the first Great Awakening, especially in America, transformed the people. They all began to be educated. They all learned how to read. They all learned how to think for themselves. They all got this sense of self-worth, self-esteem. They became self-made men. They became men directly connected to God. And they had their own sense of value. And that made Americans very, very independent-minded. And it actually resulted in... This first Great Awakening started, I'm guessing, 1730. Do I have it written down? Let me think. See, 1730, more or less around then, ended. It started waning. It was gone. Even Wesley couldn't raise the crowds like he did before. And Whitfield was waning also. When Whitfield died, like in 1750s or 1760s, something like that, when he died, I count that the Great Awakening pretty much drifted off. It was consolidated by these Methodists and these circuit riding preachers. It was consolidated by them, and so they did have their denominations and what have you. They didn't leave the Church of England until after Wesley died. But one way or the other, the real movement had kind of softened up a little bit by 1755 or 1760. And what came out of it was the American Revolution. That it really transformed America. It made them ready for some freedom, for some real progressive change in the way things are done. And it made a lot of people progressives. Even Christians began to be part of the movement against the king and that sort of thing. So, especially since the established church, the Church of England, whose head was the king, remember that, the king was the head. You know, not separation of church and state in the Church of England. They believed the king was the head of the church. And that really turned a lot of Americans away from the king and that sort of thing. So that resulted in the American Revolution. The Second Great Awakening, it's almost as difficult to explain as the first one. After the Revolution, everything was consolidated after the French Revolution. Lots of people frayed because of what happened in the French Revolution. America was not a very stable country. Lots of things in flux. A guy gets saved. A guy named Charles Finney gets saved up in upstate New York. He starts preaching. Now, he was a Presbyterian, old school Calvinist. Believed the Westminster Confession and all that. But He got something clarified to him, and he stopped being old school Calvinist. He didn't become an outright Arminian like Wesley, but he really did back off of the extremes, because Calvinists had gotten very extreme, very extreme. They had a split in the Calvinist groups. They would call them then old school and new school, and the new school was part of Charles Finney. Nowadays, Calvinists consider Finney a great heretic. Horrible, horrible person. If you deal with a Calvinist, they don't like Finney. They think Finney brought the downfall of the gospel. Yeah. I don't think so. I think Finney was very reasonable. But I'm not old school, hard-nosed Calvinist. I'm Calvinistic enough that I can very much sympathize with the Calvinist thinking back in those days. But I'm also Arminian enough that I can sympathize with the Arminians too. This Finney, something happened to him. He begins to preach. And his messages, if you read his message, you read his memoirs and his theology, iffy. But if you read his sermons from back when the Second Great Awakening was going, man, this guy had a way of clarifying the gospel, and it was good. His sermons are good. And he wasn't the only one. There was a bunch of people out there preaching in these backwoods areas. The First Great Awakening mainly dealt with the established churches and the mainstream groups of people. The Second Great Awakening got out into the boondocks and was saving hill country folk and backwoods people. And people were getting saved right and left. A lot of people got changed in the Second Great Awakening. And they really pushed social reform. They were strong anti-slavery. They were strong women's liberation. Not what we consider women's lib now. Back in those days, women really had no power, no rights, they were really treated as second class citizens. And they were against the way they treated women. They began to be very against drink, alcohol. They were a temperance movement started right then. And a bunch of other social reforms. They began to fight gambling and fight pornography and fight prostitution. They were really fighting for change in society. And they did it. They got it. All what they wanted, they got. Everything they were fighting for, they won. The abolitionist movement was a strong Second Great Awakening Christian movement from the start. When people say that the Bible was what kept people in slavery, they are so wrong. The Bible delivered them from slavery. Slavery's been around since forever. The Bible, where the Bible was believed and had the political power, the Bible stopped slavery. Abolitionists were Christians. They were, what do you call it? Fanatics. I mean, we're talking about fanatics. And the anti-drink, I mean, what was that Carrie Nation going to the bars and with her hatchet and start tearing up bars and everybody back away? You wouldn't do nothing to her, you know. These were wackos. Fanatics. And they were pushed by, y'all heard of John Brown? John Brown, the first American terrorist, you know, that wanted to cause a slave rebellion. He was a strong Christian. Strong, all of his sons, strong Christian. He was a preacher and a strong Christian. He went and took over the armory, the United States Armory in Springfield, Missouri, and was going to give those weapons to slaves so they could free themselves. And of course, that caused the Civil War, because that scared the South silly. They were all afraid of that. And the fact that there were Northerners pushing that, they said, we cannot trust an abolitionist. So when Lincoln got elected, they seceded, and that caused the Civil War because of that Second Great Awakening. These people were pushing strong. Anyway, now there's a third one that I call, I think it's a Great Awakening. It's probably not the same. And other people have another thing they call a Third Great Awakening, which is certainly not a Great Awakening at all, and should not even be considered. But anyway, the Third Great Awakening, what I call the Fundamentalist Awakening, started late after the Civil War. You had some men that just got tired of all the old fighting between Arminian and Calvinist and all that junk, and they started preaching on the love of God and carrying their Sunday schools to an extreme. They were very business-minded, something really happened there. Anyway, you're talking about Moody and Tory, and of course in England you had Spurgeon, very wise guy. This Spurgeon was just very stabilizing force on all these groups. I think it ended with Billy Sunday and Temperance when they made Prohibition. That was the height of evangelical power in the U.S. And you had that William Jennings Bryan, who was one of these strong evangelical preachers who ran for president three times. He was a very important person. He lost all three times, but barely. He's a very powerful man back in those days. this is what I call the fundamentalist awakening, because back in those days, you had all of these scientific advances feeling like they were disproving the Bible. You had all kinds of archaeological men finding out things and saying that the Bible is wrong here, the Bible's wrong there. You had, of course, all of the new discoveries of manuscripts and what have you, and they were saying that the traditional Bible is just, the Textus Receptus is no good. All of these things have been disproved since then. They were wrong in their thing, their ideas. But there was strong scientific push against the Bible. Archaeology, lower criticism, higher criticism. They were saying these books were written by Gnostics of the second century. You know, all of this stuff had been proven wrong. But you had geology saying that the Earth is millions of years old, and then of course you had Darwinism saying that, you know. And what happened was a lot of Christians sort of retreated into their shell, except this group of fundamentalists. All of the other Christians, all the mainstream denominations, retreated in their shell and started accepting science. But there was a whole bunch of backwoods type Christians that said no. And a whole bunch of these, and this is where we get the hick preacher. You remember Lester Roloff, how he'd talk about, well, you know, the mule out in the field and all that stuff. That's the kind of hick preacher that got famous. And it got famous because the people standing up against all these scientists were hicks. They were hayseeds. They were criticized because they were... And, of course, I'm telling you, Lester Roloff, you know, he was a college graduate. The man was bright as he could be. He was smart. But he would talk like a hick because that's... We're just believers. We're not so sophisticated and fancy that we're going to be confused by, you know, by scholarship and that sort of thing. This is where it came from. This is the fundamentalist awakening. The fundamentalists started with what they call the fundamentalist papers. They started writing these papers, fighting modernism, what they called modernism. All these Christian groups that were saying the virgin birth is a myth, and you know, they just started these fundamentalists. We believe the Bible. We believe it's word for word inspired. We believe in the virgin birth. We believe in creation by God. We don't believe in evolution. We believe in God. They believe the gap theory that the birth might be millions of years old, but God had recreated it 6,000 years ago, that sort of thing. So that what we know of now as the earth is really only 6,000 years old, that sort of thing. Anyway, these were the hayseed preachers, and people might not want to admit it, but it transformed. The truth is, the evangelical church is the most powerful church, probably in the world right now, as a group, as a movement. Evangelicals are very unified. We all basically believe very similar. Like, you can go to a community Bible church and they're going to believe a whole lot of stuff just like us, dispensationalism. And we're talking about true growth of evangelical Christianity since this fundamentalist awakening, because they just started fighting these people and arguing. What happened was they didn't win the arguments. They were not winning in the schools. They weren't winning in the... But they were winning in the churches. People were coming to the evangelical churches and leaving the mainstream churches. You get these preachers up there correcting the Bible, and people would leave those churches, and they would go where these fundamentalists awake. I mean, these people were hopping and moving and praising and preaching on the street and singing and having rescue missions and Sunday schools and bringing in the kids. And it grew like crazy, evangelical Christianity. It transformed Christianity into... our modern type evangelical Christianity, missionary-minded, anti-drink, anti-gambling, and just really a strong unit because of the fundamentalist awakening. And it basically saved the Jews, saved the world in World War II. If you'll remember, people like Frank Norris was one of the strong fundamentalist leaders. And of course, he's the one who broke from the Southern Baptists and started what's now called Independent Baptist. All the independent Baptists can trace themselves back to J. Frank Norris in Texas when the Southern Baptist Convention tried to force to become modernistic, and he pointed out how modernistic they were. And of course, you have people like that. John Birch was sent out as a missionary. He was going to school and he was making arguments, and J. Frank Norris showed up to preach and they called him a church splitter, and he went to listen to him, and he left wherever he was, I forgot when he was in Georgia somewhere. Maybe it's Alabama. I don't know. He's in the South somewhere. He left there and moved to Texas just because of J. Frank Norris. He goes there and he's sent out as a missionary out of J. Frank Norris' church back in the 30s. Goes to China and learns Chinese. He's in the backwoods. He can pastor a Chinese. He knows Chinese like... And then they had World War II. And John Birch is basically an undercover... He could pass as a Chinese. He was a short fella. And he had the face. He looked like... He could be a Chinese. He kind of looked like that kung fu guy, you know, the Glenn, what's his name? David Carradine, that's the guy. That was the face he had. He kind of looked Chinese, and he would dress as a coolie. He was not like the other missionaries, having a station or whatever. He would be out there in the boondock. He had so many contacts of churches all through backwoods China that when the Japanese attacked China, and then the United States got into war, they found this guy, and he would direct their air raids, and he would direct it, and he... You know how they found him? Because he had been in the backwoods, and even during the war, he's still back in there. And all of these Chinese Christians, who were basically secret Christians anyway, he had this entire network of spies, because these were Christians. They were pro-American. They were anti-Japanese, of course. And yet they could trust each other because they had known each other for forever. And he was all these backwoods, tracing all the way the whole length of China. He had gone all through there. When you remember the Doolittle Raid, I don't know if you saw the movie Pearl Harbor, where they had that Doolittle Raid where they fly over Japan and bomb Tokyo, and they couldn't get back to Midway or anywhere. They had to keep flying, and they ditched their planes in China, in Japanese-controlled China. Well, guess what? These guys were hidden by some of the Chinese over there, and these Chinese went and got this American. And this American, John Birch, comes over, finds this Doolittle gang and takes them to safety. He gets them and takes them all the way through all the back ways out of China, gets them to safety. And when the general found out how these people got out, he said, I want to talk to this guy. Talked to him, and he became the head intelligence agent in China, in occupied China. He ran all over it. The Japanese couldn't find him. They could not. They knew that he was there. But he was not recognizable. He dressed like a coolie. He looked like a Chinese, and he could speak Chinese fluently. And he had this network of agents all over that he would get. He would know where every movement was happening. They would send him word, and he would get it back. And that's one of the reasons why the Japanese got beat in China. And that is also the reason why the communists killed John Birch after the Japanese were surrendered. When the Japanese surrendered, remember there was a fight between the communists and the nationalists in China before the Japanese attacked. And the communists head out in the mountains. But when the Japanese backed off, the communists moved in and took over about half of China. And John Birch was in that communist side of it. And when the communists found John Birch, they just shot him dead. Because nobody could control him. He had such a huge network that they were afraid that Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists would use him. And they would have. He was a very strong nationalist guy. And so this John Birch, that's where the John Birch Society comes from, because the communists killed him, so all the anti-communists in the States used his name, because you can't trust the communists. They're not trustworthy. They killed John Birch. John Birch was a hero. Huge hero. Member of J. Frank Norris's church. Strong fundamentalist guy. He's an amazing man. But never married. Just lived out there among the Chinese, preaching out there in the Chinese. But that's basically the three awakenings that I think define America. I think that defines our American church experience in America, these three awakenings. Any questions? Modern Israel can thank the fundamentalist awakening for its existence. That's where Zionism comes in. That's where the Balfour Declaration comes in, because of the strong influence of evangelical Christians back in those days. It's where Zionism began. And what we know of as the modern world came about because of the fundamentalist awakening. It's the modern world. It's what we're dealing with right now. The Middle East and all the problems. It's World War II, how it was won and how it was transformed by evangelical Christians.
Put this in a book for us and so we can sit down and read it again.
Oh my. He got it from a ton of books.
I know, but we want the condensed version.
The Reader's Digest.
You want the condensed version.
That was the condensed
version. I know, but I need to read it again. Because you can record all of the...
I'm not going to record it.
Can you put them online?
No, I don't think so. I can't even get them.